Hey team, welcome to episode 104 of Transition Talk, where we talk about dental transitions and how to navigate the sometimes messy path to practice ownership. One of the top questions we receive at NDP is, when should I start the process of buying or selling a practice? If you want to start planning ahead, you'll need to know what factors can influence the transition and the timing of everything, and I promise you it's the number one question. And while there's not a one-size-fits-all answer for how long the process takes, today our hope is that we'll outline some guidelines to help make a plan, understand what you need to consider, and hopefully shed a little more light on the answer for you. Today we have a special guest on our episode. NDP Senior Transition Consultant Matt Doyle is here in the studio, whoop whoop, for his debut on Transition Talk. Matt is a CPA and a member of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. His background is super unique, and before he transitioned to us, he came in 2021, and we have been so lucky to have him since. Many of you listening, and hopefully some of you who haven't had the chance to work with us yet, will have the opportunity to walk through your transition and your milestone with Matt. So welcome.
Thank you, Christy.
I didn't say what your history was and your background because I want to ask you a question about it.
Sure.
You have been a middle school math teacher.
Yes.
You have worked for the Big Four doing more private equity in the tax world, like private equity. And you've also worked in the tax world doing like small business tax returns. Which is worse best?
Well, definitely both have their advantages and disadvantages. I loved my time in the classroom and working with the kids, so I don't have anything bad to say about that experience. Obviously, if you talk to anyone who's done taxes, you know that busy seasons are something that haunt you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So I just interned at one and I was like, never again. I can't. As a mom of a seventh grader, bless you.
Well, it's great. I have three young kids, and so... Well, I know now what I am going to be dealing with in just a few years.
Yeah, there you go.
So
from a parent's perspective.
Danny, Nikki, and James.
Yes, littles in your life. Well, today I think this podcast is, I'm hoping, going to be a great resource for both buyers and sellers. So if you're listening to this, we're going to kind of tackle this from both sides like we always do. And I want to start first with the sellers. And I'll caveat that we are going to assume that you know what type of transition plan you want. So we're going to assume you know you need a walk away, or you know you're going to give a partnership, or you're looking for an associate that you can one day make a full or partial owner. And if you don't know how to know that, I'm sure we have some podcast episodes about that that you can go back and listen to or email us. So we're going to assume you know what your plan is. And so we're just going to say, hey, if you need to transition, all of our questions are going to kind of be applicable to any kind of transition that might be in your future. So let's start first with those individuals who might be listening who are probably 55, 60 and are thinking like, hey, I need a plan. I don't have a buyer or anyone to kind of transition my practice to. We ask this question on our intro calls. We say, hey, if we find you a buyer tomorrow or someone in your network kind of falls into your lap tomorrow and says, I would like to buy your practice, are you ready? What would you say are the most critical things for a seller if we ask them those questions, or what would you think they need to make sure they have in place?
I think one of the most important things that, from my experience, that I could recommend is, even if you're not in the immediate future thinking, I want to sell in a couple of years, being prepared and knowing that it's going to take time to be prepared for that transition to happen. And the sooner you start planning for it and start thinking about the different components that are going to be important to consider, the sooner you start implementing some of those procedures and the sooner that you start understanding what you're going to need to do when that time eventually comes, the better. You may a lot of times like, I want to practice for 20 more years and something happens. And so I think one of the most important things that I can recommend is understanding what the due diligence process is going to be required and asked of you from the buyer side.
Yeah, I think that's so, so important because a lot of you listening, especially single doc practices, heck, even multiple doctor practices, you're used to just getting in there, doing the clinical work, processing the payroll. You're not looking at a lot of these reports like a buyer will look at them. And so I kind of think this breaks down into like almost two phases of due diligence, more like the financials and then the practice management. So like on the financial side, what recommendations, kind of what types of things do listeners need to be aware of as they think about their financials and the due diligence and kind of what to do and what not to do? Give us a couple.
Yeah. And I think as an experienced practice owner, you know your practice in and out, you know the numbers and it all makes sense to you and you don't have to think twice twice about it. But knowing that someone is going to be looking at your practice and they don't have that same perspective is important. Mm-hmm. And so one of the key pieces to start thinking about is there are going to be lots of questions that are going to be asked as it relates to your financials, the tax returns, the financial statements, the profitability. We all know cash flow, overhead are those major starting pieces when it comes to what is my practice worth. And when it comes to your financials, I think the cleaner the books are, the easier it will be for the buyer side to complete their due diligence. There's a couple different components here. First of all, consistency is key. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with, you know, many transactions on the buyer side and the seller side. And when there is variability in how expenses are captured, what expenses are included in those financials, the more difficult it is for the buyer, whether it be the buyer to understand how your practice is performing, the lenders that are obviously going to have to make sure that it meets their risk appetite and portfolio. Mm-hmm. Those are all very important.
Yeah. And I think on the consistency piece, it's like we've seen practices, I know that we've worked on ones together where it's like they've changed accountants every single year that we've worked, or they do the books themselves and they don't really have a rhyme or reason where things go. And so like 1 year supplies is crazy high and one it's really low and they don't really have a record of like their general ledger just has credit card payments and it's really hard to understand. And again, none of this indicates that there's something wrong with your practice. It just makes it hard for a third party to come in and say, this is the practice, this is the stability of the overhead, and prove out what you may know about your practice. The goal is someone else is trying to prove this out, right? So like being able to look at supplies across the year. And if you have a implant heavy practice, you're an ortho practice, and you have aligner and you do traditional brackets, like being able to break out those and being able to see those, I think consistently from a financial standpoint is really, really important. And then clearly we all know you run some stuff through your practice, right? We've seen all kinds of stuff.
Absolutely. And that's what Charles and Christy preach all the time. It's why it's important and why they want you to own, because there's so many tax planning strategies available as a business owner. And some of those examples that Christy was referring to, we've seen practice owners that have not reviewed their financials consistently over time. And there are expenses that have been captured in the material direct costs like supplies and labs that should not be in there. Or there's material purchases that are lumped into a general account. And knowing that on the buyer side, they're going to need to understand why there is variability or what is a true practice expense versus some of those discretionary costs, that the more consistent you can be, the easier you can explain or track your expenses, because we're not going to be looking at just 1 year. We're going to be looking at multiple years. So the easier you can set up your bookkeeping to have those costs easily identified will save you so much time throughout the process.
100%. And so I think, you know, if you're thinking about, hey, in a couple of years or I'm 5 years out, like start looking at your financials, make sure that you're happy with your accountant, make sure that they're bucketing things in the right area, make sure your chart of accounts is good. If you aren't happy with your accounting, maybe you don't get good communication. Maybe when you ask questions, you don't get good answers, or they don't ask questions enough to make sure things are in the right place. All those things will start to matter. And the sooner you start to get a handle on that, one, I think the better your practice probably will be and the clearer your financials will be, but the better off your diligence process will be. And I promise you, it will save you lots of headaches post finding that right person and just probably give a lot of clarity to the process. So that's the financial piece. There's the other side of the coin, and it's the practice management system. A lot of similar advice here, but some other, I guess, differences here in regards to certain specialties and just different types of reports. So what's your advice on the practice management system from a diligence standpoint for sellers?
Yeah, just like the financials, the buyer and their team is going to be looking at consistency. They're going to be looking at key indicators that show how the practice has performed historically, as well as what can they expect going forward. So in terms of, we always ask for or receive questions when we're working with the seller, you know, what does your new patient count look like? What is your referral sources? Where are your patients coming from? When it comes to your patient base, how much of your practice is insurance versus fee-for-service? How much is Medicare? Being able to identify what makes up the patient base from the production and a collection standpoint is hand in hand as important when you're reviewing the practice management with those financials together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for practice management, I mentioned ortho earlier, I think that this is an area we really struggle with when we work with orthodontic clients. And it's because some are really, really good. They work with certain practice management consultants, or they work with Kane Waters, and they fill out monitors. It's how many phase one, how many phase two, how many aligners, how many D-bands. Others don't, and they rely on their practice management system, and they rarely, like you said, they know their practice. They have a gut feel for how many cases they're starting, but they've never really had to run those reports or see those numbers. They've never had to think about what their contract receivable balance is. I guarantee you it's something we'll ask for. I know it's something buyers will ask for. So really understanding how you're putting things into this, how's your front desk, how your treatment coordinator, how are they putting things into the system? Are those numbers making sense? And just getting a feel for those, I think the sooner you can start doing that, the better. Lots of good resources within our team, within the Kane Waters team. If you need help kind of figuring out what you would need to track, like, encourage you to reach out, and we're happy to have a, you know, a quick coaching call with you to talk through these various components and like how to make sure those things are consistent. So if you don't have a buyer, you're trying to get ready, right? Those are getting ready. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about, or just didn't say, like, are you ready to actually sell, right? Like, I mean, I think that Charles would be disappointed if we didn't say, like, are you mentally and physically ready to sell? Are you ready to kind of say goodbye? We didn't actually talk about this beforehand, but we've had several practices that are not two doctor practices where they said, we're ready to find a buyer, but I want to work back full time. And like, why is that a challenge?
The challenge is when we are looking at a practice that historically has been a one doctor practice and it wants to bring in another associate, or you want to sell but you want to work back, there are some potentially some challenges that need to be addressed. Some of the immediate things that come to mind are, does the practice actually have space to have two doctors practicing? Mm-hmm. If you have a limited number of operatories, what is that going to look like for you and that buyer? Are there going to be enough chairs for the both of you to practice? When we look at the space, is there room for potential expansion? Do you need to expand?
And will the buyer who you're going to sell to want you to expand? Do you want to make it bigger, right? Are they wanting a smaller practice and that's why they're interested?
Exactly. And a lot of times if they're wanting a 100% transition, not always the case, but a lot of the times those buyers are ready to take over, mm-hmm. and they're ready to get in the practice, and they understand that transfer of goodwill is important. But making sure that post sale or post transition, that what the buyer's goals are, your practice is set up to meet those. And if what the buyer is looking for and what your practice is capable of do not fit or not well aligned, then that's going to make it challenging.
Yeah, I agree. So I think to sum up that point before we move on, right, you need to mentally be ready. You need to make sure your practice works for what you want to do and be how involved you want to be post-sale. You need to be upfront with those expectations. And then you just really need to be educated about your own practice. From a third party's perspective, you need to look at your practice through a different eyes, understand your financials, understand your practice management system, and really be ready to put in the work to give a team like ours the information so they can present your opportunity in the best light and really relieve the questions that a buyer is going to have. What are some factors that affect the timing of finding, right? If I don't have someone, the timing of finding that right person, what are some things to think about there?
There's always the unknown of how quickly will I be able to find a buyer, mm-hmm. and how quickly will I be able to find a buyer who has the same goals or their transition plan aligns with what I want as the seller. One of the most important factors, it's always about location. Mm-hmm. And if you are in a rural area, there may not be a lot of potential buyers that are looking for a practice in your area. Whereas think about a more urban setting, a lot more people, there's a lot more opportunity to have potential buyers looking to either join your practice or buy your practice.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to what we just talked about too, which is like, if I need to work until I'm 65 to meet my plan, but I'm in Dallas, a real super desirable urban area, if I start looking too early, I'm going to find someone and they're not going to want, need, practice and have space, you know, fill in the blank, cash flows don't support having me work back. And then I don't have that security of having that cash flow for that amount of time too. So I think from a timing perspective, not only do you need to consider where your practice is, like you mentioned, but also in relationship to that, how long do I need to work back? Because then you can kind of work backwards. If I know I need to be in this practice, or I'm not willing to work back for someone else until I'm 65 and I'm 62, and I know it's going to be very easy for me to find someone, maybe I don't start looking until I'm like 63 and a half. That doesn't mean you're not preparing, hiring us to figure out what the price would be, cleaning up the financials, understanding your practice. There's a lot you can do in that time period to ready yourself, but maybe you don't actually start physically looking for someone until a little bit closer. Okay, what about what happens after you find find a buyer? So timing, we get this question a lot, right? Like once I find someone, like what happens next and like how long can the process take and like what makes it shorter and faster? What are your thoughts on when I just kind of broach that very large topic?
Yeah, when you find that potential buyer, you know, ideally there has been discussion and agreement in terms of those major components. We think about the price, we think about the structure of the sale, we think about the timeline of when that transition is going to occur. So assuming hopefully all of that has already been discussed and agreed upon between you and your potential buyer or potential associate, then as we move forward to we have these agreed upon terms and now we need to make this happen, hopefully each buyer and each seller has their own transition team that is walking them through the process and helping them make sure they are prepared for all of the steps that will need to be taken in order to make that sale complete. That being said, when you have the more people involved, then there's more opportunity for delays. Everyone needs to be working under that same timeline. So I think making sure that you as a seller, that your transition team, your attorney are on the same page and they understand what your goals are and that they can actually make that happen is extremely important, because whether it be anyone on your team or the buyers, if one of those is not on the same page, you can only move as fast as your slowest team member. And that works with your team and the buyer's team.
You've heard me say this a lot, like humans are hard and this is a very emotional process and there's a lot of different opinions in the space. So I 100% like I've heard that, but not in this context, but you're 100% right. Like the slowest person on the team is what causes, clearly not you. You would never get so frustrated, but there's lots of audible groans from my office sometimes. And it usually is related to not someone on our team, huh?
Well, and also understanding that there's going to be so many points to discuss for the transition to happen. We always talk about the major components, but the devil's in the details, and being flexible and understanding that there is going to have to be compromise from both parties in order to make it work. And so keeping that in mind and making sure that you're sticking to your priorities and not letting something that's not as important derail the rest of the deal is especially important to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I think expectations too, right? If we expect there to be a lot of last minute requests from lenders, if we expect attorneys to redline a document, even though we think it's a fair document from the start, like also setting ourselves up for success as far as what we expect from the process, I think is helpful too. And relying on us to tell, say, hey, that's normal. It looks scary, but it's normal because it's just what attorneys do. Or yeah, banks always ask last minute for things that we feel like they should have asked earlier. I know we also get frustrated internally about those things, but it's just kind of what it is, right? And so working with good groups and good lenders and good attorneys, like even the best will have last minute things and things that frustrate us because it's a long process. Like deal fatigue's a real thing.
Absolutely. And just to piggyback off on that, keeping in mind that for when it comes to an accountant, for example, understanding that they're likely going to be busy around March and April, mm-hmm. and then they're going to be busy again around September, October. Whereas, you know, like in the summer months, this may be a great time, but that's a time where there's often vacations scheduled between any number of parties or end of the year. There's a lot of end of the years in terms of lending that a lot of deals being done. And so planning ahead and understanding all those potential conflicts that can slow the process down are very important.
Ah, such good points. So if I shift over to buyers, and some of the same things that we talked about with sellers are true of buyers, we're just going to kind of shift a little bit. There's some unique things here. But if I think about buyers who don't have a practice opportunity, right? What would your advice to be to those people who say, hey, you know, when do I start? I don't have an opportunity, but like, what do I do first?
I think one of the most important things is there's a couple of things that are important as a buyer. First of all, ideally, you know what location that you want to practice in. Again, we talked earlier about an urban versus a rural setting. And just like we said on the seller side, if you're trying to find a practice in a less populated area, there's going to be less opportunities available. In the city, there's a lot of practice. You can
drive 5 miles and see
exactly.
15.
Exactly. And another thing is also understanding your timing. If you are right out of school, depending on maybe what specialty you're in or what your history has been like, you know, lending is going to likely require some sort of production history or being able to demonstrate that you're capable of performing the work that's being done. And so just having those main components are important. And from there, you can start focusing on that particular area to identify what are the potential opportunities that are available that I can start reaching out and using my network and making connections to find those opportunities and help you make the best decision.
Yeah. And I think it's important too, because I think it's one of those things where if I am right out of school and I really want to own, right, and maybe I'm only a year out, the size of practice, like the location, the production, like it will make the pool smaller. And also, am I looking for a partnership or am I looking for a walkaway, right? Like some people are, I'll do both. It's really rare that someone truly wants both. Like I think people start to become a little, I just want to own and I can own in whatever capacity, which I think is not a good place for you to get to. I really want you to own the type of practice you want. So being very thoughtful about, I want a partnership, or I always want to work with someone because I love mentoring, or I really want to own by myself because I can't imagine like sharing control with someone. Like, know those things about yourself very early on. If you're listening and you're in dental school or residency, like you might not 100% know what type of practice you want or exactly what you know, but you know who you are as a person. And so like starting to think about those things, I think is really, really helpful. So what about timing, how long it takes to find a practice? Talk to me kind of about those types of, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but so maybe we'll kind of expand this to be, there's things that affect how long it takes to find a practice and actually like get under LOI. And then there's things that maybe prolong after you find it, right? And kind of actually getting that LOI and then post LOI kind of along the same lines as seller. So like, what are some timing things that buyers need to be aware of on both sides of the coin?
Well, if you haven't already located a practice, clearly, there are many different places where you can locate practices that are currently on the market or they're available to sell. And so those are always the easiest ones to, when you're looking at a particular area, you can say, oh, here's a potential pool of practices that I can look at. But I know it's been mentioned in previous podcasts, that doesn't always mean these are not the only practices available. And it doesn't mean it's the best practices to look after. There's always a untapped potential for practices that aren't on the market or that seller is possibly thinking about making that transition and they just haven't actually gone through that process. And I know we've talked about letter campaigns. And again, I can't stress reaching out to your network and building and maintaining those relationships through dental school at your other relationships to help make those connections. And time again, we've had referrals that where potential practice owners have found their opportunity from somebody that they know in the industry, whether it be a teacher, a fellow student, or a former colleague.
I just talked to someone this morning who saw us at our last Hinman event as a buyer, and they were at that Hinman event and they met a doctor who had a friend who knew a person who was looking to transition their practice, right? And so it was just a conversation, right? Like the person they actually met at that event wasn't the person to help them. It was like the friend of the friend who knew the friend. And I just think that is what we need, you know? And I think that people underestimate like how it actually works. I think good practices, rural practices, I think that you have to utilize those methods. Like you can always list a practice. And like, I still think that's a very, you know, we have that service. We post practices on our website. We also get lots of practices and buyers who come to us who found something through someone else. And again, they're not all great, right? Like, and I stress a lot to the buyers, like, if you are ready to own, you can't just be ready to own anything, right? You still have to do your diligence. Like owning a bad opportunity is probably worse than owning nothing, like for a minute, you know, unless you have the opportunity to improve it. So being thoughtful about that piece, I think, is really important.
Yeah, and just don't limit yourself to what you can currently find on the market. Always utilize those relationships because you never know who's going to talk to somebody else who knows somebody else that's going to find you the practice that you're looking for.
All right, Matt, I'm going to give you the honor of giving us a final thought. So Teacher Matt, at the top of the episode, we kind of said the reason that this episode came to be was that we often get the question of like, when should I start the process of buying or selling a practice? If you had to answer that question, kind of in summary of everything we've talked about today, what would your answer be?
I think the answer is to always start preparing now if you haven't already done so, because you never know when that opportunity or your priorities might change. So you never know when that opportunity is going to come up that you did not know existed. You never know when what you previously had in mind for years, when those priorities shift or why. Mm-hmm. And so I think from a buyer side, I think setting yourself up for success in terms of being prepared from the lending perspective, building those relationships are always important. On the seller side, same thing. Networking is going to be crucial, especially if you don't have somebody in mind, because it works both ways with finding somebody that's going to be the right fit.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that you said that very well. I think that if you're listening to this podcast, it's probably a pretty dang good first step. And you probably need to be doing these other things we've talked about in this episode.
Absolutely.
It's been so fun. Was it as fun as a happy hour?
It was. Well, happy hours with you are always fun.
Oh, yeah. But.
This was definitely more intimidating than standing in front of a group of 12, 13, 14-year-olds trying to teach them algebra.
Oh, okay, so, good. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I'll take it. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. And if you're listening, always make sure to share the Transition Love with those who may not know of us yet and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. Thanks for joining us on episode 104 of Transition Talk. Until next time, friends.